The Coast 89.7 is proud to present the latest edition of our radio documentary series produced with the financial support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program. Curating Cape Breton's Multicultural Mosaic, a dedication to diversity past and present, is a Coast 89.7 original production. And now, The Story of Home with your host, Donnie Antle.
Welcome to The Story of Home. I'm Donnie Antle. In this episode, we examine a culture that is perhaps most closely identified with Cape Breton, the Gaels. Both the Irish and Scottish who came to Cape Breton had an outsized impact on Cape Breton's very identity. Their music, language, and dance have come to typify what it means to be a Cape Bretoner. Tourists from around the world flock to our little island to experience Gaelic culture every summer. The Irish came here first, before the Scottish Gaels. Ken Donovan is a historian and author. He lives in a house in Inganish that dates back to the 1820s, built by Irish settlers who also bore the name Donovan.
And the Donovans of our house, Jeremiah's second youngest son, builds this house beginning in the 18... Part of it is built in the 1823, and James Donovan and Catherine Power build the main part of the house in 1853. 1823. So I've got very good data on the house, and what's able to take me back is oral evidence, and then when you get that, you use archaeological evidence, historical maps I was able to get through Parks Canada at Louisbourg, aerial photography, land grant records. So... And then you examine the house itself as artifact, right? You look at the house and you say, well, what am I seeing here? So you better get good advice. So I got architects, a couple of architects, a heritage carpenter. We'd peel back the walls and tell me what I'm seeing, and then we'd have drawings done. So when you're young, you think you can do anything. And as it turns out, you can. But like if you saw this house when it was first... We bought it in 1990. It was a dump. Everybody said, put a match to it, right? And that's usually what happens. But my wife and I were on the same page. We said, okay, let's do this. And we saved this house. And what's distinctive about this house is that it's a working class house, all right? Most working class houses do not survive, because it's not a considered of high enough style, not fancy enough. But if you go into this house in Inganish, it's very similar to the houses you find in Louisbourg. You have hemlock on the floors, pine on the walls and the ceilings, you know, hand-carved pine. And the walls are not, the floors are not painted, okay? And the walls are non-bearing, half-timbered house. A lot of similarities. We found all kinds of artifacts in the walls, like a shoe. And guess what? The shoe is homemade, and it's made with wooden pegs, two layers of wooden pegs, just like they found in Louisbourg. So there's a lot of carryover from the 18th century into the beginning of the 19th century. Like that theme we're talking about, you know, early settlement going well back. Well, you can find it in... tangible culture, material culture. So like a house is a material culture. So you go into that house, 1820s, and when our grandchildren, Donovans, come from Mexico, they are the eighth generation that come into that house of Donovans.
The first Irish came to Cape Breton when it was still called Île Royale, in the immediate aftermath of the Treaty of Utrecht.
The Treaty of Utrecht was 1713, and the French had been in Placentia since the 1680s, fishing. It's a beautiful community. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's just gorgeous. And the Irish are there fishing with the French. And so when the French have to get out in 1713, the British take over, they come to Cape Breton, primarily to Louisbourg. But they also come to various fishing communities, mostly along the northeast, southwest part of the coast, like Inganish, Baleen, Manadou, and then down along the southwest coast from Gabarus on down. And so there are not a great number of Irish, but they're Irish who are here with the French for all sorts of reasons.
So why didn't they stay with the English? I mean, there was a commonality of language there.
Well, that's true, but I think the big thing for the French, at least in the early part of the 18th century here, is they want to live among their co-religionists. Like, religion, not so much nationalism, was the big dividing line. So after the Act of Union, 1707, when England and Scotland become joined, England identifies itself as a Protestant nation. And that they align themselves against mostly a Catholic Ireland and mostly all of Europe, which is Catholic. So it seems a little bit strange today, but religion was the dividing line, not your nationality so much. So they're more comfortable having their priests and their own religion. So that's a large part of the explanation.
There were Irish servants and merchants living in Louisbourg. And ironically, when war came to Ile Royale, there were Irish on both sides of Louisbourg's towering walls.
But there's quite a mix of Irish here in the 18th century. You've got the Irish who are with the French, okay? And then you got the sieges of Louisbourg. So guess what? The Irish are fighting on the New England side, right? Mm-hmm. And there's wonderful evidence about these guys and the people. From, you know, it's John Kelly who's on the Long Wharf in Boston, ready to get his pay. And then the British Navy comes along and presses him in the Navy. He's in there for 6 years. And so he writes a long summary petition, you know, for compensation after he gets out. So you eventually have Irish on both sides of the wall, so to speak, you know, with the French and with the New Englanders and later with the British. And in the 1750s, the British Army is here, 30,000 men under James Wolfe and Geoffrey Amherst. That's a lot of people. And believe it or not, by the mid-18th century, almost 50% of the British Army were made up of Irish. And the reason for that is not because they love the British, but it gave you a steady job, it gave you your meals, and you had a purpose. And you could take your wife and kids with you even, you know. So life is complicated, you know what I mean? It's like in the American Civil War between 1861 and 1864, the bulk of the fighters on each side were Irish. Oftentimes people can be exploited, right? And they're vulnerable because they're poor and looking for circumstances and employable circumstances. So it's the nature of life, you know. So you find yourself on opposite sides of the same war. And that happened at Louisbourg. And honest to goodness, I can name pretty close to 1,000 people of Irish descent who were at Louisbourg in one way or the other, either with the French, with the New Englanders, with the British.
After the siege of 1758, many Irish settled in the Louisbourg area. They were there to greet Abraham Cuyler's group of loyalists when they landed in 1785.
So there's like Francis Nearing settles on the Myra. He's definitely he's Irish and he's in the British Army. There's a whole raft of Donovans that are in there that settle. But let's look at the people, the Kennedys, the Slattery's, the O'Toole's. Let's see who else is there. The Powers, the Doyles, all of these people, the Kehoes. Some of them were with the French and some of them were with the British. If I had my druthers, I think the most were with the British and they get an opportunity to either get away from the British Army or get permission to settle.
Meanwhile, a group of people in the Highlands of Scotland begin to look west to make a new home. These people were the Gaels. When discussing Gaelic culture, there is no better person to speak with than Geoffrey MacDonald. He's a Gaelic singer, teacher, and activist. I spoke with him by phone about the Gaels and the impact they've had on Cape Breton culture. He brought me up to speed on the earliest roots of Gaelic culture.
1,000 years ago, Gaelic was the main language in Scotland, so it was the language from the king down to the poorest in the land, and your government would have been done through Gaelic language, and the church was a Gaelic church. Law was through Gaelic, medicine was through Gaelic. It was a very highly civilized culture. And the thing started swinging down for it roughly 950 years ago, when one of the last true Gaelic kings that reigned for any amount of time, his name was Macbeth, and Shakespeare writes him up as a villain, but he was actually a pretty decent leader. He ruled for 17 years, and he was able to go to Rome on pilgrimage through part of that time, which tells you if you can leave your kingdom and go for an extended trip, chances are you've got your ducks in order, as far as nobody's going to dethrone you by the time you get back. But anyhow, he was defeated by Malcolm III, the next king of Scots. And Malcolm III was originally a Gaelic king, but he married, his second wife was an Anglo-Saxon princess, and we know her as St. Margaret of Scotland, which, as I said, she was actually Anglo-Saxon. And what was going on through England at the time was that the Normans had taken over, and they were taking the power away from the Saxon lords, the Anglo-Saxon lords. Some of those Anglo-Saxons escaped into Scotland, since they were nobility and that. She would have been part of that group. Well, she wasn't any big fan of Gaelic language and culture, and she had a strong influence on her husband and on three of their sons were the next kings. So the upper class in Lowland Scotland changed from being Gaelic in language and culture to being Norman French for, let's say, 150 years. And then when they stopped ruling through the French language, they never went back to Gaelic. They went back to a language that had sprung up amongst the more common people in the towns and the such. And that was a dialect of Northern English. We know it in Gaelic as Avewa Galta, the Lowland English and that. And that happened, like I said, roughly 1,000 years ago. So that's when the decline began. By the 1400s, you had enough of a split of English-speaking Scotland and Gaelic-speaking Scotland that it was like two nations within the one area that we consider Scotland now. English-speaking Scotland was more so the lowlands to the south and east, and Gaelic Scotland to the north and to the west. And you would have had warfare from time to time between those two nations, but you had bad feelings between the two constantly, where the Gaels viewed the English-speaking Lowlanders as people who came from Gaels and turned their back on who they were as a people and got softened because they wanted to be like the English to the south of them. And the Lowlanders, the English speakers, took the view of the Gaels as being barbaric and savages and backwards, uncivilized and that.
Joyce Rankin is the director of the Old Sydney Society.
There were would always have been a trickle of people, but the bulk of them came between 1790 and 1820 sort of time. So that was historically, so it's after the Battle of Culloden. It took a while for that to really affect people. I mean, it affected them right away, but in order for them to start leaving in such huge numbers. So, but there were still people leaving. So, for example, I'm from Jodik. There were a group of people came in 1776 there, and that was one of the first settlements on the island. And they had left. So they had left Scotland in the Outer Isles and gone to Prince Edward Island, and they were there for a couple of years, and then part of that group left and came here.
The Gaels had very good reasons to leave their homeland and make the dangerous trip across the Atlantic, as Jeffrey explains.
That came to fruition where Gaelic society was defeated in the 1700s. They were kind of, the clans were almost kind of an anachronism at the time, that in the same island of Great Britain, where you had the Industrial Revolution going on, you still had a warrior culture up in the corner of the country, or of the island. And you had boys being trained to be pretty deadly warriors, starting their training at the age of 7, roughly, and that. So it was interesting, come 1745, that some of our clans were able to raise an army, and they were going to put their own king on the throne of Great Britain. So they still had military power enough. And after 1,000 years of Celtic leaders leading their men from the front in battle, you still had that going on in 1746 at the Battle of Culloden, that clan chiefs were standing in front of their men and leading them in battle. So you had the chief, the young chief of Clan Ranald, got badly wounded in the head, and the chief of the Clan Cameron had his ankles broken with grape shot, and the chief of the MacDonalds of Keppoch died from wounds from musket balls and that. So you still had Gaelic society, even though it was anachronism, was still living on strongly enough, just less than 1746, so not too many years before big numbers of Gaels started coming to PEI and started coming to Nova Scotia. But after the defeat at Culloden, the British Army just massacred the prisoners in a way that they wouldn't have treated any other professional European armies. And then over the coming weeks and months, they went through the islands and glens, especially if those clans that had supported the prince, known in English often as Bonnie Prince Charlie, and really gave a lot of payback to those people. And it was a form of ethnic cleansing, where they went through the glens and the islands, and they burnt their crops so they have no food, burnt the roofs of their houses down so they couldn't inhabit those, took their cattle, which was the basis of their economy. If they couldn't take the cattle, they'd just shoot them with a rod where they were at. They raped women and girls and did away with some of them when they would be finished, and they just murdered at any age. And one of those who was in charge of a detachment of 320 British soldiers in this pacification of the Highlands was Cornwallis, whose statue was taken down in Halifax, and this was only 3 years before he came over and became governor of Halifax. So those who were spreading the British regime and whose sons and grandsons would be spreading the British Empire that much more, they learned how to do it in defeating the Irish Gaels and the Scottish Gaels, and then they kind of took it on the road.
Well, it was big business for the ships, right? Mm-hmm. So actually, after slavery was abolished, both in Britain and a bit later in the United States, but in Britain, the ships that had been used as slave ships carrying people from Africa, that was a big business. So when the British got out of the slavery business, there were all these ship owners with these ships, which really couldn't be used for anything else. So a lot of them were converted into immigrant ships. And in fact, some of them were converted so that there were restrictions on how many slaves you could have in a certain space. That point, there weren't any on immigrants. So some of the ships were actually converted to take more people. And so the more people they could take, the more money they made. And there was no incentive to get them there alive. The mortality rate was like 20% or something like that.
Those who had the boats were looking at a way to increase their profits. So they were saying, well, why would we be going across the Atlantic empty and then take a load of wood back? If we could take people over there and make profit that way. And it tells you something, because lumber ships weren't the best vessels at their time. And if you had a good ship, you would use it earlier on to transport a lot more expensive goods, like tea and spices and silks and that. And at the end of the line for a vessel's lifetime, hauling lumber would be one of the last things you would do, because it wasn't such a big loss if you lost the ship and the load was just wood and that. So some of these ships would be in bad shape and maybe even chained together because of rot within the structure. And then once it hit stormy weather, it'd break up. So God knows how many were lost at sea.
Historian Daniel C. Harvey wrote about Gaelic immigration to Cape Breton in an issue of the Dalhousie Review in 1941. He wrote that many of these ships would drop off their passengers, without so much as a penny to their name, wherever wind and water had carried them, regardless of whether there were officials to greet them or, preferably, where there were not. The largely uninhabited island was a smuggler's paradise.
There were no permanent habitations there, so the Mi'kmaq were back and forth. You know, that was part of their territory, but they didn't have permanent habitations there. So as far as the captains were concerned, this was, you know, empty land and, you know, up for grabs, so to speak. And so, yeah, they just dropped them off you know, in many cases, they didn't really know what they were getting into. Some of them would have corresponded with relatives or friends and had a rough idea of where they wanted to go, but they didn't always get taken there.
Meanwhile, a second wave of Irish immigrants come to Cape Breton in 1815.
Well, we've got good evidence in that of that. First of all, by 1771, first real reliable census, we have 168 Irish that we can name. There's a nominal census. And so that's pretty early, right? And then by 1871, that's 100 years later, there were 7,311 Irish in Cape Breton. And they represent almost 10% of the total population, okay? So, and total population is a little over 75,000. So they primarily settle in Low Point, and that's the big area, from Low Point, South Bar, down to Low Point, okay? Right to Glace Bay, right along where I drove out this morning, out to the station. So I just want to name this to you, because it's about 25 miles of coastline from South Bar down to Glace Bay, right? Mm-hmm. Got pretty darn good farmland, and there's fishing available, and you've got safe anchorages at South Bar and Lingan. So you've got, you know, a good stretch of land there, and that's where the Irish settle primarily, and that's known as the Irish Grant. And that takes in a number of communities, Gardner Mines, New Victoria, River Ryan, so Kilkenny Lake, all of that area. You know, you drive along, you see the signs, right? So that's primarily Irish. And then from there, they branch out. They branch out to Sydney Mines to work in the coal mines. But that's the Irish Grant from South Bar down to Glace Bay.
Those early Irish Cape Bretoners lived a simple rural life.
We have evidence of their material culture, and they were primarily fishers and farmers, and that's what they did in this house here. They moved down to the coast in the spring, as a lot of people did, and they'd have their veggies and root crops, and there was a lot of kin and family around you, so they'd support each other, you know. And that if you got family support, you got the world by the tail. You do. But if you don't, it's not so easy, say the least.
The same could be said of the early Gaelic Cape Bretoners who made their home here.
People had it pretty rough here for the first while, especially if you came from islands where you wouldn't even hardly have a tree, and you're dropped into the middle of the round forest, as they say, and your job is to use a broad axe, and just with the strength of your arms and your back, every day go out and knock the woods down for what is going to be your fields and your farms and that. So the first generations would have worked extensively, strenuously for quite a while. They wouldn't have had horses and oxen to plow the land. It would have been with foot plows and the such. But then once they got on their feet, say within a generation and a half or so, they had a lot more than what they had in Scotland as far as their independence and the good food and that. They really came to bond with the places and to love them. And because they had immigrated here in a form of migration known as chain migration. They were settling with family and cousins and that.
The language, music, and culture the Gaels brought with them survived, even as it declined in Scotland. But why did it survive?
To answer that question, I'm going to drop back in history again. The strongest part of Gaeldom, and by Gaeldom I mean Gaelic Scotland, Gaelic Ireland, and Gaelic, the Isle of Man was a Gaelic-speaking island as well, still is. And the strongest part of Gaeldom was Ireland. So if you were a bard or a physician from what's now Scotland, chances are you'd be going over to Ireland to learn your craft that much better. And as a people, the Gaels of Ireland, as a society, as an autonomous society, they were defeated in the early 1600s by the English, especially would have been partly by Lowland Scots, English speakers as well. But that was the early 1600s, whereas it was almost 150 years later that the Scottish Gaels were conquered by the British state. And one of the main reasons for that was isolation and geography. If you go to the Scottish Highlands and you see how much more drastic the geography is there compared to Ireland, it was also drastic when it came to you taking an invading army into the place and, you know, impose your will. By the way, it was a lot easier to fight invaders in the Highlands of Scotland than it would have been throughout Ireland. So place, location can make a big difference. So when you come over here and you look at Gaels settling first in big numbers in Pictou County and then in Inish County, then through Cape Breton, you had Gaelic being lost first as a language and as an identity and as a culture, and that in Pictou County. Part of that was because the industrialization of Pictou County, well, the industrialization, what was the main language of that, and what was the main language of urbanization throughout North America was the English language. So these folks in Pictou County were influenced, bombarded a lot more by this big wave of English language and culture. They're the first of the Gaels in Nova Scotia to be facing that. That's why the Gaelic language went out there earlier on. The next place was Inish County, and then it rolled over in the late 1800s or so to Cape Breton. And I just wanted to mention, numbers-wise, at the turn of the 20th century, there may have been as many as 100,000 Gaelic speakers from Pictou County and Inish County, part of Guysborough County, and throughout Cape Breton. So we had real strong numbers. But the music tradition and the dancing tradition and singing and storytelling and the language lasted longest in Cape Breton. A big part of that is just the isolation, that it just took longer for that big English language and cultural wave to come through. And it was coming through with the railways back in the 1880s and 1890s and that, and with English language newspapers later on with the radio and all of that. So the fact that we were a distance farther from the strongest proponents of that English wave and that definitely helped out. But I think there may be another thing, and that is, who are the people that settled in these areas? There was a top Gaelic scholar was asked years ago, and very familiar with the Gaels of Cape Breton, and was asked by someone, well, why is it that in Inverness County it seemed to live on as long as it did, that you had the Gaelic language, the storytelling kept going, the singing kept going, the dance piping and fiddling and step dancing and that. And this scholar hardly batted an eye, and he goes, oh, he said, the Clan Ranald. And what it is, a lot of the Clan Ranald, the majority of them left their territories in Scotland and came to places like PEI, but especially to Inverness County and to Inish County. And this same clan is the clan in whose territories the prince raised his flag, raised his standard to declare his father king back in 1745. So two of the main clans that were helping out were the MacDonalds of Teppach and the Camerons, both Lough Aber clans. And you'll find their descendants in Enniginish County and in Inverness County as well. So that didn't help, or didn't hinder any, for sure, to have descendants from those clans staying in this area. Part of that would have been the fact that they were Catholic, and the Catholic Church was more supportive of things like Gaelic folklore and the music and dancing still going on, as opposed to some of the Protestant denominations, and I think of Presbyterianism and that, wouldn't look, depending on the minister and that, wouldn't look too kindly upon the musical and dancing traditions, and would look upon the storytelling as kind of a way of spreading lies and that should be shut down.
Well, there wasn't a lot of in-migration. I mean, so we've always had the thing where people left, but not a lot of people came. So after that initial flood of immigration, not just the Scottish, but the, you know, the Acadians who were returning and all that sort of thing, and the Irish. And like, so here around Sydney, you had, when the steel plant, you know, opened, there was a big flood of people. But that didn't affect the rest of the island. So so basically after that initial big immigration in the, you know, say, we'll say 1790 to 1820 kind of thing, there wasn't a whole lot of additional immigration. And the people, you tended to have fairly homogenous communities. So mostly Gaelic speakers. And then somebody who came into the community would be more apt to learn Gaelic rather than vice versa. You know, we have one person come into a community of 200. Well, that person's going to have to learn the language, right?
It is to the Gaels that we owe what has become the musical instrument of Cape Breton, the fiddle. Don Beaton is the artistic director of the Celtic Colours International Festival and a great fiddler in her own right.
Well, the origins of Cape Breton Scottish music has obviously, as I've just implied, come from Scotland. So through the Highland Clearances, there were thousands of people that were displaced and found a new home on the shores of Nova Scotia. So originally to the mainland, and then further ships coming forward would have gone directly to Cape Breton. Also PEI, and that's how a lot of this all links together. So kind of as an Atlantic region or maritime region specifically, that's the origins of it. So so we can identify a lot of our tunes and style direct back to Scotland. So we do, we play a lot of the same tunes that are still played there.
Dr. Heather Sparling is an associate professor of ethnomusicology at Cape Breton University.
I think that the fiddle tradition is deeply linked to a number of other cultural expressions. So it's deeply linked to bagpiping. So we have a number of ornaments and ways of playing the fiddle that can be linked to the pipes, like lots of droning, for example, or the ornaments that we use. It's very linked to step dancing, so that the fiddle playing is directly, in many fiddle traditions, they were once linked to dancing, but have kind of been separated. Whereas here in Cape Breton, the fiddle tradition is still very closely tied to step dancing, and that really dictates tempos and rhythms. And then the third thing is language. So Gaelic also really influenced the fiddle tradition as well. So we have a whole repertoire of fiddle tunes called Pwrs da Beal. Those are the song versions of fiddle tunes. So that the idea would be that people would actually be thinking of these lyrics in their heads as they were playing the equivalent tunes on the fiddle, and that the rhythms of the language would then translate into the fiddle tune playing.
The piano styling is very important to the story of Cape Breton, the sound that Cape Breton fiddle invokes. So it's very syncopated. If people have access, or you know, went to, say, the Beaton Institute or the Interpretive Center in Judic and accessed the archives, if you ever heard home tapes, house recordings, reel-to-reel recordings back in even the 50s, the style is a little more, I don't want to say simplistic, but it's a bit more pared down. It's not quite as syncopated as it has become. And that has created these wonderful rhythms that when we teach step dancing, those are encouraged. We try to evoke those same rhythms that match or could line up with the piano chording style. So the right hand and the left hand are doing very different things, further driving the fiddle and the fiddler to create that uplift, lively beat that will, of course, translate into the dancers, be it solo dancing, square dancing, that sort of thing. So it is a really fundamental piece. And it does occur in some other places, but not quite to the sound that we've kind of had on a world level. Like, there are pianos elsewhere in the world, but that's kind of interesting too. I mean, the early part of Cape Breton's history had pump organs, and that created a different interaction between the instrument and the player. And there's a lot of stories of, you know, when the trains were coming through, and especially I think in the 30s, they were really rolling off the tracks. That became something really pivotal. It's found in a lot of homes, as we know, in Cape Breton.
Historically, there would have been three main spaces in a community: the home, the school, and the church. And there really wasn't, when people first came, a place outside of the home to play. So people played in the home. There wasn't room for large ensembles. There wasn't room for piano would have been really difficult at the beginning. Certainly people didn't even have the money for that at that time, as Don kind of alluded to. Everything would have happened in the home. So the playing of the fiddle in the home, the bagpipes in the home, the dancing in the home, the stories, the Gaelic songs, everything. Some would happen in the schools. So what we would also get is we would get the school teacher was paid for by the community. So they would have schoolhouse dances as a way of fundraising. And so there would be a fiddler there, unaccompanied, maybe two fiddlers, and they would play for a small dance in the schoolhouse. And we really don't get the halls starting to be built until around the 30s. We don't actually have a really great history of some of the halls. The halls emerged in part, it seems, because of parish picnics. So parish picnics were really big from the end of the 19th century right up through the beginning of the 20th century. These were fundraisers for the church. These would be summer events, they would be festivals, and they would always have square dances and step dancing as part of the event. And there would be fiddlers. But of course, if it rained, then this had a negative impact on the parish picnic. So the halls seem to have been part of an effort to try to create a space where some of these events could happen regardless of the weather. And of course, then they could also be used year-round eventually. I think some of the earlier halls were not four-season halls, actually. And of course, the bigger the hall became, the bigger the sound needed to be by the fiddler to fill the space, and also the more dancers there were. And of course, the more dancers there were, the more feet that were clapping on the ground, and the more talking there was, the more the instruments had to be able to be heard over that. And so eventually we start to get into stages to elevate the fiddlers up above the sound of the dancers. And of course, then we get amplification eventually coming in, and things like pianos coming in to help also create a larger ensemble sound.
The preservation of Gaelic culture isn't just happenstance. People like Jeffrey MacDonald have dedicated their lives to keeping the Gaels' traditions alive.
I went to Cinevex a generation ago, and we began a Celtic society there 30 years ago. And sometimes it was like pulling teeth trying to get the young people who would go to dances back home to come out at dances at the university in Inish, because they were worried about their friends seeing something that was okay at home, but not up to style when you're in the real world at the university and that. And last Friday night I attended a dance by the Celtic Society, still going, and full of young people who were keeping the dance floor full and playing the music themselves and that, and a fair number of them speaking Gaelic. And myself and a couple other friends who were around a generation ago, we never would have dreamed that this would happen, that you'd have a healthy generation coming through with no stigma against who they are as Gaels and their language and culture, and that they're proud of it and really enjoying it and embracing it.
Actually, that was going to be my next question, because I know now the Gaelic language, even in Cape Breton, sort of, as time moved on, with the introduction of sort of standardized educational, a standardized education across the province, for example, where that sort of reduced the number of Gaelic speakers. And there was a point where Gaelic speaking, like the Gaelic language, was sort of under threat. But it seems to have reborn itself.
Oh, it's still very much under threat. It's I think about it as if you look at a cancer patient that's been on the way out for a while, and then sometimes they'll rebound for a few days, just a few days before they die. So I don't want people to think that the situation is, there's some beautiful, miraculous things going on when you look at the young individuals that are involved and how much they put into this and how much they love it, but it's still a very fragile situation. I come from a community where I used to speak lots of Gaelic, and to speakers who had a very high register of Gaelic and were very good singers and storytellers, and there's only a bit of that left in that community 20 years later. So this is all very fragile. But one of the most positive things, when you have any language and going out, and because of that, people not identifying with that language and not identifying with their own people because of that going on, well, that happens because you've had a lot of bad going on over a long period of time. Often it could be hundreds of years. So if you look at the Acadian situation here, where they're fighting to keep up their language and culture, well, that goes back to Le Grand Brangement, the expulsion of the Acadians, and that. It's their story, and that's bad enough. But that takes you back to 1755. And as I was saying, for our own people, where our downslope began hundreds of years before that. So there's kind of a miracle that anybody even cares, let alone loves learning this language in that amount of time and that. There was actually legislation against the Gaelic language itself and the Catholic faith back in 1616. So that's over 402 years ago that was enacted in Lowland Scotland to try and get us to stop being Gaels. So you have this stuff, like I say, some really bad stuff going on over a long period of time. And those who want this to happen are kind of victorious once the people and once the individuals themselves internalize this. And they say, yeah, I'm embarrassed of being a Gael, but I'm not embarrassed of being a generic North American, so I'll drop my Gaelic ways behind. Earlier on, it would have been, I'm not embarrassed of being British and making my way through the social system, but I'll stop being a Gael in order to achieve that. And that gave the message to those back at home that if you're wanting to succeed in this world, stop being a Gael and just get on in the British system as well. And for some individuals, that worked. If not spiritually and culturally for them, it worked for them economically and socially, and that to get them higher on the list kind of thing than the farmers and fishermen that they came from and that. But as part of that process, you have a stigma, and it's almost an unspoken stigma going on for generations that your people are not as good as the conquering people and that. And I would say with us, that stigma was still around healthy enough when I was a young man, that people would say, well, isn't it nice that you're learning the Gaelic language, but why? What's the sense to it kind of thing? And I'd say somewhere around 2008 was when I noticed that stigma was almost gone, that the generation that was coming after me didn't have the hang-ups of being embarrassed of somebody hearing them speak Gaelic and things like that. And that's the way these things come back. If you have individuals plugging away over decades and over generations, hopefully you've got enough fight to pull everybody through. And then you'll hit a point where you can start growing from there. So as I've said to ones, all of us involved in keeping the Gaelic language alive and keeping the Gaels as a people alive, realizing who they are in Nova Scotia, you've had a lot of individuals having a long slugging match going on between ourselves and just, are people just becoming generic North Americans for quite a while, and I think over the last 10 years we're starting to see the payoff for that, where you have young people that are really embracing this stuff and are talking about their own children being Gaelic speakers right from birth.
Culture goes beyond music and dance, or even language. A culture is also a mindset, a way of seeing the world. As Ken Donovan said earlier, the tight-knit Irish community had a culture of taking care of each other. That sense of community found expression in two priests of Irish descent from the Margaree, Father Jimmy Tompkins and Father Moses Cody, founding figures in Cape Breton's cooperative movement.
And you need energetic people, and, you know, these people were always looking to the priests, and they were well-educated, right, usually, and they're usually bright people and well-educated, and people glom on to them right away. Hey, you know, like, you got to go away and get educated. And one of the few ways to get educated was to become a priest. And so I would say that's definitely a part of it, you know, with Tompkins and Cody, you know. And these, they had a vision, both of them, Cody especially. And, you know, a hard-driving man, right? He would never give up, you know what I mean? Credit unions, whatever. Cooperatives, people, schools, organize, you know what I mean? So, yeah, they were hard-driving. They were thoughtful. And that's not to say that the Irish always cooperate, you know, because you could have all sorts of conflict over various sorts of things like any people's. But these guys were lining support up and making sure they had their ducks lined up before they started to, you know, to rally people. But usually they're looked up to. If you have respect, you'll follow somebody, you know, and you need leadership skills for that, right? That's critical, I think, you know. So that's hallmarks of both of them. Tompkins was more of a parish sort of guy, but Cody was, he was head and shoulders above everybody else, I think. So
at the top of the show, I said that Gaelic culture had come to typify Cape Breton. And tourists come in their thousands to experience not just our island's natural charms, but also a thriving, growing Gaelic culture that exists nowhere else in the world.
You do have these individuals who have stepped. They never had to be in that bad stuff for very long, and all that of being made fun of for liking this kind of stuff, and that as my generation and many generations before that did. So to me, these young people that have embraced it and are proud to speak Gaelic wherever and dance wherever and that, they are what we'd call Gashki, which is warriors or heroes. There's a program down at the Gaelic College called the Gashki Yawk, the young warriors or the young heroes, that you can use the word interchangeably. And I see some of the ones who came through this program, this is the sixth year, as some great leaders that we will have in the next 10 and 20 years and that. But still, it's at the point where these people are still individuals to a degree. They are symbols to their people, which is something vital to remind everybody if it's not entirely lost in who we are. But unless enough change is effected in the next few years, a big enough change, it could remain that it's just these symbolic people keep the memory alive. Or it could be that the right things are done and you have that these symbolic people are actually just average people, because you've got so much more, many more of the population are embracing this stuff and taking back their language and the language of their ancestors and getting involved and learning songs, stories, learning an instrument, learning to dance and stuff like that. And that's, to me, that's where the greatness can be. And we've still got something really special here that if somebody comes from anywhere else in the world, they can experience something, and when it comes to Scottish Gaelic culture, they can experience something here that they're not going to get anywhere else. The old music of the Highlands and Islands, and the old dance and that, and some dialects that are almost gone in Scotland are still stronger here and that. That's it's thanks to the individuals who played the fiddle all their lives and kept plugging away at the Gaelic language and watched their mother or father doing steps and picked up those steps from them. And that those are the heroes that we need. And hopefully they're each one of them I see influences 10 or 20 people around them. Hopefully we're going to pull in that many more people and we'll have that many more Gashbis to bring about something that could be, like I say, kind of a miracle.
I think that there's a great deal of fame around the Cape Breton fiddle tradition. And part of that is just simply because our accessibility, like the accessibility of music, is so much greater now. We can hear music traditions from around the world using YouTube, and it's just so easy to hear. And the tradition in Cape Breton rightly has a really famous name. Does it have a, are there a lot of people learning it now? I think that's a good question. And I always think about actually something that Dawn said to me one time, where she said, you know, maybe it's not the number of fiddlers that are the problem, but do we have an educated audience? And so thinking about how do people learn not just to play the instrument, but to really listen and to understand what makes the difference between a dance player and a player who's more for listening, or the difference between a Scottish player and a Cape Breton player, or maybe even more like a mainland versus an island player, that the ability to really understand that playing from that deep level was something that was really part of this tradition in the past, because people were just surrounded by it all the time and really listening to it and really thinking about it. And that's really changed over time. So I think, you know, the question will be, you know, I'd like to say that I don't think that the tradition is in danger at this point, but I also think it's changing. And I think that one of the questions that we have right now is, how is it changing and how does the community respond and feel about that?
It's funny. I had one person in my job as the artistic director of the festival. I've had conversations with other artists from, especially in the country, and they're like, well, what do you play? And I said, oh, we play Scottish music. And they're like, well, why don't you say Cape Breton music? And it really stopped me in my tracks. And I thought, well, that's a fair question. But I'm like, we play so many Scottish tunes. I mean, we're pulling from a repertoire that goes easily 200 years ago and more. So, but there have been a lot of recent Cape Breton compositions. I think the very first book, if I'm not mistaken, was in 1940 that Gordon Macquarie put out, Cape Breton Collection of Scottish Melodies. And see there, it's built into the title, Scottish Melodies. So we were kind of finding our own identity, I think, in that realm of contributing back our interpretation of the tunes, or our flavor of tunes. And as Heather mentioned, all of those factors with the dance and the piano, syncopation, all of that has fueled the sound that we know as Cape Breton fiddle today. And so our trajectory has taken a little different path than, say, the current Scottish fiddling. There's still so many commonalities there. But there are phenomenal composers, as Heather mentioned, Jerry Holland and his far-reaching tunes that they go so far around the world and a couple times around that people forget they're actually his tunes. That we did a show about this with Brenda Stubbert, that Joelle Foles came up with the title, Brenda Stubbert's Real, as in R-E-A-L, as in she's not like a person that lived 200 years ago. This tune is actually real, because people over in Scotland and Ireland kind of just assume this is a very old flavored tune, given its context. So I think we forget the impact that Cape Breton has. For a small, small island, it's had some far-reaching impacts. Darling is Beaten from Abu Dinar had thousands of tunes, like at least 2,000 tunes, two books from that. Dalangus has one book. It's interesting how intergenerational that particular skill set has become known to us. So Dalangus' son Kinnan, his daughter Andrea, all have a wealth of tunes that they've composed. And then go down the branch, I mean, we could get into genealogy in the process of this, but you know, Rodney MacDonald, Glenn Graham, they're all relatives, they've also composed. John McDougall wrote 40,000 tunes. I mean, there are some incredible volumes of our compositions that do great things in the world.
A special thanks to Dr. Heather Sparling, Ken Donovan, Joyce Rankin, Don Beaton, and Jeffrey MacDonald. Tapa leave. On the next episode of The Story of Home, we visit one of Canada's most culturally diverse neighborhoods. We visit Whitney Pier.
Curating Cape Breton's multicultural mosaic, a dedication to diversity past and present, is a Coast 89.7 original production. We would like to thank the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Radio Meters program for its financial support of this series.